excision number 12376, reel 1.
Mr. Simpson, reel 1. Could you, we start by your telling me where you were born, please?
I was born in Salisbury, southern Rhodesia.
Which year was that?
1923, on American Independence Day, 1923.
4th of July.
Yep.
What did your father do for a living?
He worked as a clerk of works for the government, and I had never really known what he did because he died when I was 5, and many years after it, my older brother, he was 6 years older than I, was living in South Africa, and I went back to see him, and I asked him then, what did my father do? Oh, he said, I remember it very well. He said he built all the prisons and police stations in the Transkei. And so I said, well, can we go and have a look at them? And you can tell me all about it. So we drove all the way through the Transkei, and we pulled into these little towns and pulled up outside the police station and said, Dad built that, and Dad built that. And the policeman would come, what do you want? Well, my dad built this. We just want to have a look at this. And it was a great experience.
Were you educated in Rhodesia?
No. My mother was left with 3 sons to bring up, and she was a school teacher and could have got a job in South Africa or Rhodesia, but she panicked a bit, and her father sent her the money to bring us back to England. And we arrived back in England in April 1929, and she quickly got a job as a headmistress in primary schools, and I was brought up in a little village called Studley Roger, which is near Ripon in Yorkshire, and we all got scholarships to Ripon School, which is now Ripon Grammar School, and so we were educated at Ripon, which is a very fine school.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I was at school.
In Ripon?
Yes, I was then 39, I was just 16. I was at school in Ripon, joined it was the Air Defence Cadet Corps, and then it became ATC, the Air Training Corps, and I was the SWO, Station Warrant Officer, in the ATC. When I left school, I went back again after the war, and my job was taken by a chap who was Regimental Sergeant Major in the West York, so I felt very pleased that I handed on to a good man.
Do you remember that the war announcement in September 1939 had any impact on you at all?
It had quite a bit, because I had a brother in the Merchant Navy, and that worried us quite a lot. He was subsequently, his ship was sunk and he was captured, and I remember that very well. That was shortly after the start of the war. He was in the Indian Ocean, was taken in by one of these raiders, and I remember that very well. So he spent all his war years in Germany as a prisoner. My elder brother was in the Metropolitan Police, and so we got, when the Blitz started, of course, we got very worried for him. And then he subsequently was released and able to join the army. He joined the army, so my mother had one in each service.
How did you feel about the war declaration?
About
the war declaration?
I think we'd all realised it was inevitable that it was going to happen, and something had to be done about it. Ripon was a garrison town for the Royal Engineers, and so we were closely associated with the army, and prior to the Norwegian campaign, the Lincolns and everybody else that were based in Ripon, a lot of them were based in Ripon, and so we were closely involved in the war, although we didn't get any bombs over Ripon as such. And then we had the RAF stations quite close, Dishfuth and Topcliffe, and I've forgotten the names, more of Catterick, were very close to us. And we had RAF officers billeted with us, and so our association was very close. The one that stayed with us longest, he was eventually shot down over Osnabrück, and he was my size and shape, and his wife asked me if I'd like his uniform. Well, I wasn't even in the Air Force at that time, but I was destined for the Air Force, so I took them, and when I came back from India, there were all these uniforms which I wore. I'm very proud to wear them too, because he's a great man.
How and when did you join the Air Force?
Well, I joined the Air Force by joining the short university course which they sent us to Edinburgh, and that was in 1941, 2nd of February 41. It was a very interesting course. And one of my great friends on the course was a chap called Peter Boyle. Now, his father and his uncle were both air commodores, and his mother, I don't know the detail, was divorced, and she married Trenchard. And so, with a pedigree like that, it was inevitable that he would be selected, and knew a lot about it. And his father was one of the selectors of the people for this course, and there was, I think, 7,500 applications, and only 150 of us were selected for this short university, and I was on the first one. And it was a very good course indeed, with a very high power. Everybody that were of the 7,500 had to be specially recommended by their headmasters to go on the course, and I felt very pleased that we had been one of the 150 that were selected.
So it was a course at Edinburgh University, yes. But to qualify you for the RAF?
Yes, we did the standard university, physics, chemistry, maths, and another very interesting course, meteorology. And then, in addition to that, we did all the syllabus for the initial training wing for the Air Force, with navigation, signals, and whatever that entailed. I forget the detail now, but the initial training wing, drill and all that sort of thing.
Do you think that the course prepared you adequately for what was to come in the war?
Oh, I think so, very well. I think we were especially lucky, because although there were 150 in all, there were only 30 of us at Edinburgh, and so we got a very individual attention by a lot of very good instructors. And just on the meteorology aspect, after the war I then had to take my civil licenses, and meteorology was one of them, and I knew it all backwards, because we'd gone into very great depths of meteorology, and so I was able to write the, I didn't do any studying for it at all, and just wrote the meteorology paper. And that was one of the papers that caused a lot of problem to people taking their civil licenses, but we had a very good grounding indeed.
You were telling me earlier that you went on the Empire training scheme.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, we again were very privileged. We were told that wherever you choose to train, you will get your choice. There were available, there was the UK, there was America, there was Canada, there was South Africa, and there was Rhodesia. And whatever you choose, you will get. And I, actually, being a Rhodesian born, elected to go to Rhodesia. And five of us went from Edinburgh, wanting to go to Rhodesia.
This is 42, is it?
Yes, 42, yes. And unfortunately, when we got to Durban, we found that the schools in Rhodesia were full, and so we stayed in the Union and did our training there, which is very good training indeed, very good. We were roughly half and half South Africans and half Royal Air Force. And we got on very well together.
How did the South African population greet the RAF people in their midst?
Oh, wonderfully. I'm still in touch with... They had a wonderful scheme. We were near Johannesburg, and we got weekend passes, and you could go into Johannesburg and go into a place called the Jewish Guild, and there were banks of notices there. Whatever you wish to do, phone numbers, you phone up if you want to play tennis, you want to go horse riding, you want to go swimming, you just phoned up somebody and they say, yes, come on, they'll come and pick you up. Well, this Peter Boyle and myself didn't want to do any of these things. We just wanted to go to a home. And so we phoned up the number and they came and picked us up. And people called Downs, and I'm still in touch with them today. And Peter Boyle and I, every weekend we went to stay with these people. And it wasn't until after the war that I heard, or she told me, that the day we phoned up, she had heard that her brother had been killed flying with the RAF. And it made us feel even more humble. She never mentioned that at the time. It must have been a great shock to see these young people in RAF uniform, knowing she'd never see her brother again, because he was killed in the RAF. Marvellous people they were. And it just entertained us wonderfully.
Did you ever come across any hostility from South African people?
I personally didn't, but the Ossifa Brandwach, the OBs were there, and they occasionally would pick on some lone airman and have a fracas. I know that one occasion they picked up a chap who happened to be a pretty good boxer, and he gave a good account of himself, but they were fairly isolated. They never worried us and didn't deter us from going into Johannesburg or anything like that, no.
So they were a pro-German element?
Oh yes, very much so. Of course, it was only Smuts that got South Africa into the war on our side.
But did you come across people of Dutch origin who were pro-RAF?
Oh, very much. We had people on course with us who were Afrikaners, and they were very good. They had a lot of difficulty, a lot of them, because the course was in English, and they had only a basic English schooling, and they had quite a bit of difficulty, but they managed to do so. The chap that came out top of the course was an African, very nice fellow, Mike Lowe, and he was really first class.
Was South Africa a good place to train to be a pilot?
Wonderful, because the weather was so good. I mean, we flew every morning. We were flying by 5 o'clock in the morning, and then we'd do a stint and then go back and have breakfast, and it's amusing. I was a big fellow and I was a growing fellow, and we used to queue up after you'd been up for 2 or 3 hours. You were hungry and you'd queue up with your plate and they'd slap an egg and some bacon on it. And I said, I always have 2 eggs. Why do you have 2 eggs? I said, my religion. Bang, came 2 eggs. Every morning I got 2 eggs. Why does he get 2 eggs? It's his religion. I found another thing. If you say it's a religion, nobody ever argues with you. And the other thing was quite amusing. We, on course with us, we had a chap, he must have been 40, a South African. He very much a South African, although his name was McLeod. And he had a I don't know what they call them. It's a station, they call them in Australia, a farm, a large farm, quite near the flying training school. And he had trained his native boys how to handle a tiger moth on the ground. And so if you were an early morning detail and really very hungry, you could land at his farm, have a quick breakfast and take off again and fly back to base, having completed your exercise. And everybody felt it would be 3 or 4 tiger moths parked on his homestead, and we always thought we got away with it. And then when I met my instructor after the war, he said, we used to see all you chaps down there having breakfast. I wish we could go and join them.
So South Africa must have been a luxurious place to live in 42 compared with Britain.
Oh, indeed it was. Marvellous. Wonderful place. And of course, everything was so cheap. We could, they had not only the Jewish Guild, but, and I don't know, but the women's voluntary services were there wherever you turn around. You could have we used to get a bed for sixpence a night and a meal for a shilling and that sort of thing. Wonderful food and things like that.
How keen were you to get onto operations?
Oh, very keen indeed. And this was, you know, get on, and that's in South Africa. You know, firing training went uninterrupted. Over in this country, of course, it must have been awful. Weather with problems and delaying the training. But an interesting sideline on the training, that the RAF never cut down on giving you your basic training. And it's always been my theory that that is why we won the Battle of Britain, because the pilots were better trained. And this came to be proved because in 1955, when Germany was allowed to have an airline, Lufthansa asked British European Airways for training people to go and train their pilots to be training captains. And I was selected as one of the 10 people to go to Germany to train Lufthansa's pilots. And then we got from them the story of the German training, and all they did in their flying training was give them circuits and landings. They were never taught climbing turns and descending turns and how to get out of a spin and all the basic stuff which you can see in the logbook that the RAF were given. And they just did not know how to fly airplanes. And those that survived and taught themselves to fly were very good pilots, but they had an awful lot of casualties on the way.
Which was the first operational aircraft that you flew?
It was the Blenheim 1. And they were from South Africa. I went up to Kenya, did my operational training there, and flying Blenheims, and that was the first one. And they were in a very sad state of repair. My first five takeoffs, I had an engine failure on takeoff, and the CEO said, "Well, you're managing to cope with that, so off you go solo." That was changing from Mark 1 to 2s to 4s. And they were still getting engine failures all over the place. And not only engine failures, breakdown of hydraulics and all that sort of thing. My first trip in with a crew, having a lot of trouble with the Blenheim 5, that was called a Bisley. And the undercarriage was giving a lot of trouble, so we were instructed every 20 minutes to lower your undercarriage and raise it again, which I did religiously all the way around this cross country. And when I got back to base, selected undercarriage down, it wouldn't go down. And this is my first flight with a full crew, and so I had to crash land it. And it was found that the reason the undercarriage wouldn't go down was that the Bowden cable, through this frequent raising and lowering, had worn away and it wasn't selecting. So, but that, they were in a pretty poor state. And then, of course, we went up to, took it up to the desert. I took I was the lead pilot for a squadron of Spitfires, for Navy Spitfires, Seafires, and led them all the way up to Cairo.
Which squadron was that?
I don't know the name of it, but because I lost them, I went unserviceable at Juba, which is in the Sudan, and they sent somebody else down to take over the navigation side, and I lost them then. But it was the nearest I ever got to associating with the Navy. But at Juba, I remember it well, one night we heard the tom-toms, and so we went outside and didn't think anything of the fact that we'd been getting bitten by a mosquito and so on. And we went up to the desert, and from the desert we were then to fly our Blenheims out to India. But it was a tradition in the Air Force that before a flight you always peed up against the tailwheel. It was a good luck thing, you see. I remember leaving Cairo West and peeing up against the tailwheel, and out came a thick brown treacly liquid. Well, I'm very ignorant, not knowing anything about it. I felt like death, and landed at Lida, which is Jerusalem, with a temperature way up in the hundreds, and went into hospital with jaundice and malaria, which I'd picked up in Juba.
And where is Juba? Sudan?
In Sudan, yes. And I spent quite a long time in hospital, a wonderful hospital. And in the grounds there was a statue for the Kaiser in Crusader's uniform.
Where was that?
In Mount Carmel.
So you recovered from these diseases in Palestine?
Yes, and then they put me on to a delivery flight of a Liberator out to Karachi, and from Karachi I went to Pune to this holding unit, aircrew holding unit in Pune.
Was this in 42?
I'd have to check my logbook for the date. It must. We were at Pune in October 43, and I went up to join 194 Squadron at Basal on the 21st of October 43.
Where's Basal?
Basal is on the northwest frontier. It's north and west of Pindi, Rawalpindi.
What did you find about 194 Squadron when you got there?
Well, my first night in the mess, I walked in and the CO was there, and he was a bigger, larger than life type man, and he greeted me, "What's your name?" "Simpson, sir." "Oh, well, I'm going to call you Jimmy." And Jimmy it was there afterwards, and he liked me to fly with him, and he was a brilliant pilot, but his eyesight wasn't all that it might be for looking at things in the cockpit, so I have to tell him how high we were and how fast we were and that sort of thing in en route. And I did a short time training as a co-pilot, largely with a New Zealander called Melsop.
Can you tell me more about your squadron leader?
Wing Commander Pearson, Fatty Pearson, he was a pre-war pilot. He used to fly with Wilson Airways in Kenya. And another CO of one of the squadrons, Wing Commander Fielden, he was also with Wilson, and Fielden later went to Imperial Airways. And Wing Commander Pearson built up a tremendous esprit de corps, and he was determined that his squadron would be the best squadron and that his pilots would do a better job than anyone else, and anybody that didn't give of their best was soon moved on to somebody's. He said, "But I can always get replacements." And so people did give their best because they didn't want to let Fatty down, and it was a wonderful piece of leadership.
You were telling me he had a particular attitude towards the giving of decorations.
Well, he did indeed. After we'd been operating for a long time, and some of the people had been operating for much longer than I had 2 or 3 years out there operating. Somebody said to him one night, "Sir, you don't seem to put many people up for decorations." And he said, "Why? What do they need decorations for? They're flying operations. That's what they joined the Air Force for. If they don't like flying operations, well, they needn't. I can get replacements anyway. There are thousands of people would give their eye teeth to be where you are. So why do they need decorations?" And he never put anybody up. I think he himself got a DFC, and I think he probably was quite upset by it because he didn't believe in it. During the Air Force, to fly operations, that's the aim of everybody who joins the Air Force, and that's the greatest decoration you can get, to do your operations, do them as your best of your ability. And make, of course, our job was supplying the army once we'd taken them in, lock cases. Some of them walked in, and then when we took them in, we had to then keep them supplied. And he tried to institute a relationship between a particular column that you were supplying and 194 squadron, so that you could say, "Well, I know these people, never having met them, but we supply them here and there and there." And it worked very well indeed. And the army played their part very well by, when you got a particularly good drop, they would send back a strawberry as opposed to a raspberry. And so we were very pleased, and he always insisted that the crews were told that they got a strawberry. And it's in my logbook, you'll see several times I got a strawberry, which really meant that all your load was delivered right on the target. And that's what we were doing. And of course our biggest problem out there was weather. Fly through the monsoon with no aids at all and very poor maps was very hard work, and particularly someone like myself who was very inexperienced, and you just say, "Well, that's your dropping zone, and they go and drop there," and you had to find your own way there in whatever the weather. And we developed a very good technique that we always took as much fuel as we could get on board, because the Dakota was a very willing workhorse. You could overload it and it still would perform very well. You take as much fuel, and if when you got to your dropping zone it was covered by fog or cloud or whatever, you just pushed off and waited for an hour and then you came back in. But you very seldom did you do an abortive sortie. I've got some in my book. And we often found out that the abortive sortie was because the army had to move on, and there was no personnel to man the dropping zone. And so having found the dropping zone, which is very difficult, and if you didn't get the signal lights, then you would go back home. But it didn't happen very often, because we used to stand off until we could drop the stuff where it was wanted. And nobody ever complained that, you know, a trip which should have taken 1 hour took 3.5 hours or whatever it was, because if you'd done your drop, that was it. That was all that mattered.
Was the squadron equipped with Dakotas when you got to Basel?
Yes, just got them. It had been they had Hudsons, and they supplied the first Wingate expedition basically with Hudson. And that was not nearly as good an aeroplane as the...